Seconds. So I'll just start off this talk by saying, in this talk, I'm going to revisit some of the topics of my first lecture and look at several topics in pattern matching in more detail. I'm going to include some stuff in structure manipulation, some talk about scoping constructs, caching of values, and performance considerations. I'll talk a little bit more about some pure functions, multiple arguments, attributes, sequence objects. I might talk about manipulate. I'll discuss compilation and parallel programming and sort of multi-threading, and we'll see where we get to. I think we're sort of running out of time now, and so some of this might get punted to the next day. But I can't really go on without actually a display. So sit here and, I don't know, talk amongst yourselves. Is there any questions for me that I can actually answer? Well, I don't actually have a screen. Probably not. I'll probably demonstrate them. What mathematics is better than Maple? Well, so I don't know. Is this being recorded so this goes live to the world? So that we're here. One thing I was going to talk a little bit later on was packages and defining stuff in packages. And it turns out that the structure of Mathematica is designed a lot more of a modern way. If you take a look at other systems out there like Java or woo. We have a display, so I can punt the question maybe. I'll actually answer the question and say, can I get this on both displays here? Arrangement, mirror displays. Oh, excellent, best for Crestron. Yes, we have a display, I can make this big. Okay. So I'll just say that in some of the modern systems out there, like Java or indeed Mathematica, we have a large number of system symbols. They're getting up to 5,000 in Mathematica, Java, I don't know how big it is, Cocoa, or some of the other frameworks, and they're quite large. And so the system should be structured in a way that you can actually work with it in the large. Whereas like in Maple, I think they've got functions like GoFundSubs2. And I'm not a Maple person, but GoFundSubs2, and you look at that and you wonder, what is that? You've got no idea, and so they've got these little garbage-lit functions around all over the sort of place, and so actually structuring your things in the large is quite important. So that's one thing I'd sort of say compared to both MATLAB and Maple. The other thing is we do a lot of the visuals a lot better, a lot of our visual functions are better. Actually, Maple beats us to some small degrees in some of the algebraics. We tend to leapfrog each other over time as we do development. So having a consistent sort of interface that I'll talk to you and I'll say some sort of disparaging things off camera about some of the decisions they make in terms of the design and stuff like that. But Maple is a capable system. It's surely better than some of the things like Sage, which is incredibly primitive, and some of the other things out there. Right, okay, so let's talk a brief recap of some of the stuff from the previous session. And the one thing I'd like to emphasize is I saw a lot of people actually using it. You're possibly not using command completion to the extent that you can. And so typing is actually very fast. Using command completion, getting your structures, filling in templates, filling out the various bits, and maybe changing to a traditional form or so on. So you can actually enter stuff very quickly. And one of the things, once you've got some sort of expression like this here, and plus something else, I see people often they'll go and they'll edit this particular input, and they'll change that, and then they'll change some stuff here. But when you actually want to do some sort of experiments, it's much easier to actually just go and get your last output and change that. And so then when you make your changes here, to a W or something else like that, then you haven't corrupted your sort of input, and so you can actually return it. So I see a lot of people, doesn't quite work the way they want. They'll alter the input and multiple times, and then once they've finally got it working, they figured out the problem, they don't have the nice input that they actually sort of wanted. So using the last output is quite important. One of the other things I wanted to mention again is this convert to standard form. So here up in the cell menu, convert to standard form. By the way, that's big enough, everybody can read it at the back. I should check with the projector, So convert to standard form, and this will canonicalize this expression. So I see here something that's not in two-dimensional typesetting form. I hit Command-Shift-N, and I'll get a nice sort of lovely you know, two-dimensional sort of output. It'll also canonicalize the parts, as you remember, in terms of that's actually a part symbol. It'll canonicalize things like integrate, if I can spell it, great, of, you know, that with respect to, let's say, A. I can canonicalize that. It'll work across all of these various things. So to tidy it up stuff, you know, things like, you know, derivatives, y prime of x, and so on. So you probably want to use this a bit more, and I'll be using it indeed throughout this talk to make things nice. Okay. I also wanted to recap everything in Mathematica as an expression. So everything fits into this model where we've got a head and arguments. In fact, one of the things that's an expression is this, indeed this particular notebook. So I can actually go here and do a notebook get of that notebook, and I'll actually see it's quite a long output, but I'll show all. And you see that this is actually the contents of the particular notebook that I'm working with. It's a full expression in Mathematica. And just to show this actually working, let's create a title, my notebook here, and I'll make this 1 plus A. And so I'll get a reference to this notebook here as the input notebook here, and I'll delete that reference. And so now I can go off and I can go notebook get on that previous notebook here, and I see indeed it's an expression. It's an expression like anything else. I can go here and I can get that, and I could, for instance, if I wanted to, replace, there's a character A in there, I'm going to replace it by hello. And so then I could finally turn around and notebook put that, and I get a notebook that I've actually transformed. And so I've got that notebook as an expression, and I've transformed it into a different sort of notebook. And so everything in Mathematica is an expression. And so being able to manipulate those expressions is consequently quite important. Okay, so that's the summary of that. We can take a look at the actual expressions from, I'll mention this again, this tree form. As you can see, sort of the structure, it breaks down, and so we can see the plus is an n-ary argument with, you know, A times B powers and so on. Pedro went over this particular example. I'll just sort of repeat it here. Of course, if we try and actually substitute f of x here for a particular value, let's say it goes x squared, it doesn't work. And so it's, why doesn't it work? And of course, Pedro is giving you the answer before. If we take a look at the full form, we see it's derivative 1 f of x. And so literally, as we try and replace f of x in this derivative, f of x does not appear in the full form. And so, of course, we have to do a substitution for f being a pure function. And so that, just as a recap, is that's a pure function here. That's the slot 1, as we call it. That's the first slot, the first argument to the pure function. And so we can now do this particular substitution, and we get our derivatives functioning as we should. And in a similar vein, there's many other objects floating around at various times. Here's a series object, the third degree. We're going to do a replacement, replace x cubed here in the output, and it doesn't work. And of course, by now, you know enough that it's like, what's going on? So we want to actually take a look at the full form of that particular output here, of the series output, and you'll actually see there's a series term. You can see that rational 1 over 6 there. Maybe a few more terms, and you can actually sort of see the pattern here. You can see that coefficient 5040. And so this is an internal form for Mathematica uses for series objects, and it can do neat things with these series objects, and it can operate on them. And of course, pattern matching on that will not work, and so we can just turn around and get the normal form of that particular series object, and now we can do replacements as we would. Okay, everything's an expression. So in some of the examples you've had so far in the summer school, you've done some stuff in numerics, so I just wanted to talk briefly on some of the numerics. Mark Sofronio and Rob Knapp, of course, who's largely in charge of our numerics, will be just horrified with the speed I'm going to go through this, but that spend an hour on talking about these various topics. But one of the tutorials that you'll probably find interesting is about numerical precision. It's a good tutorial. Go look over it. And it'll talk about the various different input forms of, you know, machine precision and accuracy, which I'll talk about right now. So if I have this in Mathematica, by default, when you work with it, with numbers, they work at machine precision. That's the precision of the processor, the i7 Intel Core I've got in here, or maybe I'm on some other device and it's, you know, it's an ARM processor or something else. So if I put this backtick in, this tells it to work at the machine precision. And in fact, if I take that out and take a look at the full form of that, you'll see it's sort of being added automatically. And I take a look at the previous precision of this, and it says machine precision. So I'm operating at machine precision. But let's say I don't want to do that. I want to operate at a higher precision or indeed a lower precision. So here's just a number. I'll take that out. You know, 1.0 and I'm going to be operating at 12 digits precision here. So I could see that full form, and indeed I could take a look at that precision, and I could see the precision of that number here is 12. So what happens if I get that number and I multiply it by itself? So I've got a 12 digits of precision multiplied by 12 digits, I get a number, 1, which I expect, and I take a look at its full form, and all of a sudden, I'm getting this wacky thing right here. It's gotten 11.69897 blah, 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 blah digits of precision. And so it's, what? How can I have a fractional amount of precision? I either have 11 digits or 12. What's going on here? And so it turns out, of course, in numerical methods, and sometimes they're not stable, we lose precision as we actually do computations. And if we dropped a full digit of precision every time we actually did an operation, we'd very quickly run out of digits of accuracy. So let's actually take a look here at this particular computation. What we're going to do is we're going to nest. So nest here, we go, remember your command key to actually get to the help. We could blow that up possibly, make that a bit bigger in the help system here. So we see nest of like f on x three different times. We'll just apply f how many different times, and so 5 times and so on. So what we're doing is we're just nesting this operation. We're going to nest the multiplication of 1.0 at 12 digits of precision with 12 digits. Oh, let's actually make it 45, for instance, just to be a bit different here. 45 digits of precision here, and we'll do that 100,000 times. And of course, since it's multiplying, we'll still get the number 1, but we're going to be losing some precision. And in fact, if we go and actually take a look at the full form of that, full form of the last number, we'll see we've actually lost from 45 digits, we're down to 39 digits, and we take a look at the precision of that. We're back at 40 digits. So we've lost some precision by doing these numerical operations. So in the end, I could point out, of course, if we just stuck with machine precision right here, in the end, we don't actually track that particular precision, and indeed, we're back at machine precision. So one of the options that controls this that you actually see in the help is the working precision, and this can control the precision of which you do certain particular operations. For instance, in this case, the ND solve, and this is a particular example, it does ND solve, and it does 24 digits of precision, and so all of the internal arithmetic during this computation will be done with 24 digits of precision. That'll automatically set the working precision goal, the precision goals and the accuracy goals, and so as the thing tries to converge and give an answer, if it doesn't hit the right precision goals, it'll give you warning messages and so on, and so you can set all those various bits via numerics. Why here? So we're losing each time some precision. And so, of course, if we take a look at the precision there, it goes down. So that's 45. But let's say we only do 10,000. We're actually going to only lose some digits, and we go down to 100. We're not going to lose anywhere near as much precision as we go. So this operation, we lose a little bit each time in the numeric. And so it's important for our algorithms to be numerically stable as we go. Okay, so I wanted to just give a simple recap here on pure functions. So as we talked about last time, we can have some my squared function. I can name it myself, and that can operate just, this is a simple map, of course, on a list, and it just squares every single element in the list. An alternative form for that is, you just simply enter, the a escape function escape, a squared. So we've named this variable. We could call it b or c or alpha, just for something different, alpha. It's independent. It's lexically invariant here on this particular input list. And of course, we get the same results. And in fact, if I enter this into Mathematica, I actually see it has a sort of canonical form of function, alpha, alpha squared. And here's the pure form of the function that we've seen before. We call the slot. That's the first slot. And so it just takes whatever arguments it does, plugs them into the slots, and we get our end result. So we can actually have pure functions on more than one variable. So here's the pure function form of this. We have this a and the b, and so this can operate on some like t, w here, and we get, without too much of a surprise, it's plugged in the t and the w here. A is t, b is w, and we get our result. We can actually see that this has an actual form, an internal form, of function, a, b, and of course this also works on our output. And of course we could have the slot variation as we had before, of just replacing each one of these with, I'll make that slot 1, this is the slot 2, and we make that a pure function, and of course this can now operate on t, w as well, and it works. So one of the things we actually want to take a look at probably is the full form of this, because I'm about to talk about an example that I gave in the help here. So the full form of this particular function is we see each slot has a full form of slot, and that's the slot one, this is slot two. I would also point out that these functions can actually operate on more than just the slot one and slot two or slot three. You can have them operating on slots, on the nth slots, for instance. We could have this to be all functions. This now, let's go here, and this is now going to operate on the second and third and fourth and fifth and all the other arguments here. So if I now put this in of, you know, a comma b, it is now plugged in into the slot two. It's plugged in the b, but it also plugs in anything additional, the c, you know, d, and so on. So you can have multi-argument capturing in your pure functions. Okay, so it's a quick extension to pure functions. Let's actually talk about one of the examples that Pedro managed to deprioritize in the example problems, which is one of them I gave was a functionize. So here we would like to get some sort of polynomial and some with some variable, and I'd like to actually turn that into this pure function. So how would we go about doing that? Well, we could go in here and we could get this, and we could turn around. Well, I'll just do it again. X squared plus 3x plus c. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to actually substitute x for a pure function, the slot. And so that looks good. We're almost there, full form of percent, and we can actually see we've got one of the slots, but we don't have this function wrapper around it. If I got this and I actually have the wrapper there and take a look at it, it's got this wrapper around it, function. So I need to get function around this particular bit here. I need to somehow get function. But if I put function around here like that, it doesn't give me the right answer. And why didn't it give me the right answer? Well, the full form of that is function replace all. But function itself has this holding attribute. It won't evaluate its arguments. It's quite important. It does. So we need somehow to allow this inner bit to evaluate and then get the right result. So we could be a bit uncool and put evaluate around the actual inner thing that we have and actually get the result. But possibly better, or actually better, is to turn around, and this is a trick that you'll use in some places. We've got the head of this list. So we wrap this just in a list, and of course the list evaluates. And then what we can do is we can replace that head of this argument that's already evaluated by function, by using an apply that we saw from the other day. And this is now the right answer, so we can actually just make this our... What's that, sorry? Yes, no. So that's now, we could name functions by doing this. I just wanted to show some examples. This is meant to illustrate a little bit of an exercise. It's meant to illustrate the holding attributes and a little bit of manipulation, some of the full forms of pure functions and being able to manipulate them. No. In fact, no. So if I do that, it won't work. And that's because, by our canonicalization, Command-Shift-N, again, the holding attributes of this will be respected. So in other words, it'll parse that whole structure. This will be the inner bit, that thing in the outer bit, and that will hold its arguments. So, no, even then with parentheses. Nope. No, definitely not. So we're going to use this trick here to do this function application here. So we allow this inner bit of the list evaluates, and when we replace the head, we rip the head off and replace it by function, and we get what we want. And so I could actually just, you know, write functionize some poly comma, you know, x underscore colon equals function applied to poly slash dot x goes to that, which is the whole trick. Cool. And so then we can actually just get functionize, apply it to our arguments here. Functionize, did I spell that right? Oh, comma x. Give it a variable. We could, you know, be more sophisticated and pick some powers or something else like that. Okay, so So that's functionize. It'll take it there. One of the other things, of course, since we know what a named function is, we could actually, the form of a function, if we have it, is just of course, if we wrote this out as a named function with the named function variable, would just be x comma this particular poly. And so actually much simpler in the end is just to use named functions. And of course that, you know, if I plug in t plus, you know, e, it'll do the right thing. So we could actually just turn around and make functionize here of this particular thing, just simply flip the order of the arguments and just be function of x comma poly. And so then functionize of that will do the right thing. And you know, t, it'll put it in. But that didn't illustrate my point quite so well that I wanted to actually talk about in terms of the holding attributes and using this trick of ripping the head off and having that evaluate. So, yes. No. Both will work. So if I have that was your, you know, f dashed of x, and so then percent slash dot function of, you know, a goes to a squared, and f goes to that. It'll work just as well. Yep. It's functionally equivalent. Okay. In this case, the attributes here would control the holding and some of the other bits, which would need. I'll talk about the attributes in a second. So yeah. So the answer is probably, unless I'm misunderstanding, is no. But we'll talk about that later. So structure manipulation. You've seen map. I've used it many times here. Apply. You've seen this various form of apply. We'll just simply rip the head f off and replace it by bar. We can do this at the next level down. So instead of ripping the head of the whole expression off here, list by the triple at, we'll replace the foo, the goo, the boo, and the woo here, and it'll work. And in fact, we can actually go a little bit deeper. And so we can apply bar to this whole expression, and it's going to apply not at level 1 here, there's a level spec here, it's going to apply at level 2, the A, the B, the C, and the D. And so you can actually see we've replaced it at those levels at the level 2. We could turn around and replace it only at level 1. We could replace it at level 1 and 2. And we could even replace it at level 0 as well, which is the complete head, which is list. And we can apply the various things. So like many functions as well, apply will take level specs and has a more complicated forms to it. One of the other things that I'd like to just briefly mention is sequences. So sometimes I have a run of various arguments, W, U, V, X, Y, Z, and I'd like to have this A, B, and C sort of right in there, just with no lists, no wrappers, or something else. So if I put that in, I get this list wrapper, and so I'd sort of like to, you know, go in here and replace the head with list, but it's already list. How do I get it in there? How do I flatten it out in there? And so you can actually use sequence here to do that, and it'll just sort of put that straight in, and of course, it doesn't have to be over lists. It can be over any particular head that we're ripping off here. And of course, this could be, you know, G or something else. Any particular sequence of arguments. So sequence will allow us to do that. Flatten, one of the other functions I'll be using in just a second, and I've mentioned we'll flatten at various levels. Here we're flattening out the lists at level 1. Here there's a list in the middle of the ABC. We can flatten at level 1, and of course, without any arguments, it sort of completely flattens all the various bits of the list out. Okay. So that's some brief bits about structuring. Let me just talk a little bit about some of the attributes now. So attributes are defined for many of the internal functions we have in Mathematica. One of the first ones I'll mention here is the listable attribute. And so plus, of course, if I just got that input and I use Command Shift N now to take it to its sort of canonical form, we're adding two vectors here. You know, we have the 1 in the A, the 2 in the B, so on. Okay. So that works, and that's all fine, but what happens if we get our own function here and we make that foo? So foo of that thing, well, nothing happens. We haven't given any rules for foo, and it doesn't do anything. Well, there's one other function that we actually use, another structuring one called thread. And thread will take any lists in the objects, and it'll thread the head foo over the lists, and it'll start pairing things up. So thread of that particular arguments, you see the 1 is paired with the A, the B, and then so on, and we could actually put a Z in here and would see it's sort of threaded. So it pairs them all up and it threads over the arguments. So what we can do is we can say we want this to happen, we don't want to apply thread, we want this to sort of happen automatically, and this is the listable attribute. And it turns out if we actually take a look at plus itself has this bunch of attributes, flat, listable, numeric function, one identity, orderless, and protected. And we'll talk about those all in a second. But the one that's interesting to us here is the set attributes of foo will be listable. And so now, this particular expression will, I'll just get rid of the z, make it a bit simpler there, we'll do what we want. And it sort of threads those things automatically over the arguments. And many functions in Mathematica are listable, you know, powers and set attribute of rule? Yeah, that's kind of dangerous, but yeah. C comma D. So, of course, but if you want, you can thread manually over the bits. It will be, that's probably the form that I'd use. If you set that automatically, all sorts of things will possibly break down and, yeah, it'll be bad. That's listable. One of the things I'd actually like to mention as well is the holding attributes. So let's consider this simple sort of functions here. We've got, we'll clear all f and g, and we'll define this. And so f of g of a is equal to this b of a. It could be anything. We'll call it, you know, Bob or Boo or whatever. And g of x equals x squared. So if I, you know, put in g of t, it gives me t squared. That's all good. What happens if I put f of g of t? I wrap f around it. What's going to happen? Is this first rule going to fire? And we'll get boo of the argument we've got, or will the second rule fire? Anyone? Trivial? Right, okay. I'm sure you all know that actually the inner argument will evaluate as the normal evaluation of Mathematica. So the inner argument will evaluate, and so we'll get f of t squared. And so the outer rule didn't actually fire. And so we think, nah, this isn't quite what we want. We want this outer rule to actually fire. So what we can do is we can make f hold all. And so if I go here and I set attributes on f to be hold all, and I go and I, well, I'll yep, do that. And now if I evaluate that, I'll get my boo of t. And so that rule will have fired because the inner bit of f will have not evaluated. In fact, I can even do one of the standard tricks is to put 2 plus 2 or something else that you know is going to evaluate, but it doesn't evaluate because f is hold all. So some of the various functions we've seen already, like function itself, function is hold all. As you'll see, it'll hold all its arguments. And that's the very trick we used previously just to get around the hold all by applying the function to a list the arguments. Other typical things are hold first, hold rest, and hold all complete. And you might be wondering, what's this hold all complete stuff? Isn't hold all just good enough? Well, it turns out one of the other things we have in Mathematica for associating rules with a symbol is up values. So if I try and actually change this, if I get this rule here, and I try and change D, it's going to complain about it. It's going to say, D is protected. You can't do it. Go away. We could possibly unprotect D and do some nasty things to it, but then we'd have, is this rule going to fire beforehand or after? The easiest way to do this is actually say, here's this exact same rule, but we're going to associate this rule with foo, the symbol foo here. And so if we do that, and we actually take a look at the rules for D, in fact, it says it's read protected, so we can't read it. So let's actually clear attributes on the D, comma, read protected. So we can actually take a look at the internal bits again and do this. You can actually see there's a number of bits. So there's some rules on D for make boxes and make expressions. I won't talk about that and some of the other bits, but we don't actually see our rule for D, for a derivative here on D. But if I take a look at the rules for foo, we actually see this rule foo is actually attached to foo, even though its head is actually d. And of course, we can actually do some computation here. We can say d of, you know, foo of t comma t, and will give me the particular results. If I, you know, if I go and I, if it, that doesn't match this pattern, if I use, you know, some q, something else like that, of course, it's, you know, partial derivative, it's independent, and we get zero. So we can manage to attach these up values to symbols other than the actual head of the rule, and these are called up values, and to stop that, you can make some symbol hold all complete. So I'll just mention it. It's a bit of an advanced sort of topic here, but you can use hold all complete to stop even those rules firing. Okay, so then I wanted to briefly talk about, Pedro mentioned some of this as to talk about some of these attributes for matching, and so they're flat, orderless, and one identity sort of thing. So if I have some, I'm just calling it plus of B, A, and C. Of course, Mathematica knows nothing about plus yet, so it can't do anything with that expression. If we tell it's flat and orderless, in fact, let's just actually get that and just tell it it's flat first. And here, it will flatten out the pluses. But of course, we haven't canonicalized the ordering. We've got BAC, and we know A is, you know, lexically less than B. So if we actually finally turn around and say it's orderless as well, mathematical will change the ordering automatically. And this is accounted for now in pattern matching. So we can, by saying this flat and orderless, if we give it some simple rule like this, B of A comma B plus of A comma B is this G of AB, this rule will now actually apply. And even though this form here, this plus of X comma Y comma Z, this three argument form is not matched by this two argument form. So by setting these attributes flat and orderless, the underlying structure can sort of try and match in various ways to actually allow this rule to fire, and indeed it does. And so this is now grouped like the following. As you can see, it's now it's tree form. Even for simple things, we can see it's, you know, G plus X, you know, plus Y plus Z. And so we've got this plus of a single argument. We can actually use the one identity attribute now to actually turn around and get rid of the single argument. It has some other sort of subtle effects. And now it does sort of what we want. OK, so you can use these in sort of NRE sort of operations. And we'll see this not in this lecture, probably in the next one, where I'll be using some of these attributes. And I've talked about the permission attributes here, the, you know, the read protected and protected and so on, and how to change them. OK, so let's actually start using some of these attributes and pattern matching behavior. And let's walk through some of the examples that I did. I think they're somewhat illustrative that I gave in the exercises. And the first one is to implement your own version of RIFL. And so what does RIFL actually do? RIFL just takes a particular element, and it inserts it between all of the various elements in a list. So how would we write this ourselves? We want my RIFL to do something. Let's actually get some space here. And so what we're going to do, we're going to start off with my RIFL of some, you know, args. And we're going to be tidy here. We're only going to match a list. So that'll match, just a single list. It'll match just a single list. And we're going to get a RIFL element here. And what are we going to do? So the first thing we'll actually do is just get the args list here. And we'll also generate a length of RIFL elements just as long as the list. And so we'll just put in a table of R, and that the length of that list is now just length of the args. And that's our table. And so this is our first version. And so what happens now is we can get my RIFL, and you can sort of see we get these various elements, and we want to be able to insert these elements within this sort of list. So we can actually turn around and use a transpose on the actual list here. Develop that. And now it's sort of right. Now we can actually, we talked about the flatten that I just showed before. We can now get the flatten to actually turn around and flatten this at level 1. And we now almost have it. We've got this extra element on the end, of course. And so now we have to wrap the whole thing, this whole expression, drop, and get the last element finally at the end. And so now this my RIFL will give the same sort of behavior as the system RIFL. So in doing this, I've got this sort of inner function here, this transpose. But as I'm adding operations to it, I'm flattening. I have to sort of put some bit at the beginning, put some bit at the end. And the same with the drop. I put some bit at the beginning and the end. As I start structuring these operations more and more, these things like drop become sort of dislocal. I've got these things at different parts, which as I build this up to 20, 30, 40 operations, could, you know, it's quite hard to actually follow. So a better way sometimes, and in this example it's simple enough, but a better way is actually sometimes to go, get through here. We'll get that output and go here, and let's just grab that and replace that. And so what I'd like to do is just do a single operation to it. I'm just going to apply some operation to it, and this will be the flatten operation, and it'll be all bundled up as a pure function here. And so that will now, I can get rid of that version. Everybody can sort of see it. Remember it? So that's almost what we wanted. So we've got this inner part of our function doing stuff, and now I've applied a pure function to the end of it. And so then I'd like to apply another pure function here just to do the dropping of the various bits, and I can actually call that drop of minus 1. And this now is the right answer. And so this is structured differently. I've got my inner bit. I'm applying a flatten to it, and then I'm applying a drop to it, and then maybe a factor, simplify, so on and so on, which is a lot more in terms of a functional style. So it's sometimes nice to structure your code in that way. It will not. It'll just convert it a little bit more. It won't smartly actually turn around and do that. Good question, though. So now I'd actually like to talk about scoping. And so with blocks and modules, and so this Nikolai actually used this in one of the previous editions of the school. And so, you know, we want the, you know, how many roots of the Hermite polynomial here. And so he defined it like this, and you know, you can get the answer, and what it's basically doing, of course, is it gets this n solve. It solves this in the fourth degree for how many different solutions, and it gives you the roots as a list of rules, and now we just apply x to those list of rules, and we get our list. So that's nice. So f of 4 works, and everybody's happy, and you know, f of 5 works, and everybody's, you know, smiling until someone goes and pokes their eye out by defining something like x equals 2, and we get the wrong answer here. So we get the wrong answer because, of course, it's substituted into a naked version of this particular polynomial. And so here, if I've plugged this in, 4, I plug in 2, of course, there's no solutions for that if it's plugging in, because in this definition here, x has the value of 2 because I sneakily, or someone did it there. And so, of course, 2 with no rules is 2, and that's why f of 4, f of 5, or f of whatever just gives me 2. It's not? It's true. It's true. But then again, if n solve for some reason gave 2 goes to 2 goes to 5, it might work. So n solve of something else, if there was some other function here, did something else, it might transform it. But you're right. It's messed up in both places. So how do we actually get around this? So what we do is we turn around and we use a block. And what does block do? So we structure this. And this is a scoping construct. And this says, inside the body of this block, basically treat x dynamically as it has no values. We'll forget everything else about the outside of the world. We'll treat x just like a blank symbol. We'll do our computations, and at the end of the block, will restore x to its former glory of whatever values it sort of had inside there. And so now, with that in there, if I have f of 4, even if x has a value, inside this block, x will be treated as some neutral variable. It'll do the substitution as per normal, and everything will work. So we use block to do those kinds of scoping. So here's another example using block. And attributes, here was an example where we wanted to, and the examples again, we wanted to get the reverse list of the roots of some polynomial. So foo is this particular argument, so let's actually create this, do it. And so our simple version, we might say, we'll use a compound expression, solution equals solve of the poly, comma, x, and then we're going to say slash dot x goes to solution, and probably reverse that list of various things, and return it. So that would be fine, and if x equals, you know, dot, then is undefined, then we can actually go here, and indeed it will return, it'll solve the polynomial, assign it to solution, it'll return the reverse list of the roots. So that works, but of course, as before, if x equals 2, and in our particular solution, it all goes horribly wrong, because it gets substituted in here, and here, and here. So we'd actually like to turn around and put this in a block to actually do this. And we'll make solution, we'll be clean and make solution not escape as well. And so doing this, you see this x is highlighted. And so it's complaining as well because I've used it in a block and as a pattern variable here. But it's actually the right thing to do because we do actually want that same x there. So the syntax highlighting is a good hint, but it's not always exactly what you want. This time, it still gives us a problem, of course, because it's plugging in right here. The arguments get evaluated first, and so it tries to you know, it'll evaluate that, and then it can't actually plug this into the polynomial. It can't solve it. So what do we need from before? We don't want these arguments to evaluate, so we turn around and we use set attributes of the foo to be hold all from before. OK, and so now we get our solutions. X equals 2, And so we've used our blocking solutions, again, to hide the scope and from the outside and have these as sort of neutral symbols. And we've used our hold all to make sure none of the arguments actually sort of evaluate. So let's actually contrast these with modules. Generally, blocks are faster than modules. There's certain advantages to modules at various times. But to give you, again, a little bit more of an idea of the scoping of these things, let's actually quickly talk about this particular example. What will be the output of this? We start out in the outer scope, y equals 1. We block it. We print it. We assign it to 2, print it, and print it again. What should it be? Yep, indeed. Yy 2, 1. There we go. So of course, on the outside, once the first print statement there that it's hit, yy is neutral. It has no values. We assign it to 2, so it's printed in that scope inside. And then on the outside, yy will get restored to its particular value, and it will actually work. So if I turn around and I have no value for x, block of x squared will just give me x squared. If I have a value for x here, 2, and I evaluate this now, what will be the output? 4. Indeed, better evaluate it. Indeed, it's 4 because it's evaluated to be x squared inside the block. Once that escapes the block, infinite evaluation, we can evaluate it, and it will turn out to be 4. OK, what's this module? X equals 2, and module, does anybody know the answer here? Yeah. So indeed. So what happens is module is different than block. Block sort of says, temporarily, I'm going to pretend there's nothing for x, and it works with x just like a normal symbol. Module, on the other hand, replaces all of x's with a temporary symbol, which is quite distinct. It scopes it to be a completely different symbol, a temporary symbol, and it does the computations with that. And in this particular case, we've returned it, and so it's escaping the context there. And so block is sort of dynamic scoping. Module is lexical scoping. And you should tend to use blocks. OK. So one of the things I was also going to talk about here is some simple bits of performance. Some of the stuff that you've done in the summer school is actually ranging into the bits where things take a bit of time to compute. And so let me actually walk through one of the examples, which is pretty naive, of course, but I'm trying to illustrate the points and how these things actually work. So let's give a naive implementation of the Fibonacci numbers here. And so fib of n is, of course, n minus 1. Plus fib of n minus 2. And we want fib of 0 to be equal to 0, and fib of 1 to be equal to 1. OK, and so then let's take a look at the eighth Fibonacci number. It's 21. Agrees with us. Yep, 21. So it's pretty simple. And to keep Collier happy, we'd probably turn around and actually put this to be only in integers to work with, and is greater than 0. OK, and so that does what we want, and so it works fine for fib of 8, you know, fib of 21, you know, gives us an answer. Fib of 25, it's fairly fine. And once we hit fib of 30, things are starting to slow down quite dramatically because, of course, this is a doubly exponential algorithm here, or it's an exponential algorithm, sorry, I should say, because, of course, fib of 1 will be, fib of n minus 1 will be written to, you know, fib of n minus 2 plus fib of n minus 3. So we're doing fib of n minus 2 twice. Fib of n minus 3 will be done 3 times, and so on. It gets very bad. So let's actually, just to show you some, take a look at the quick performance of that, let's actually get a table of the timing of the Fibonacci of we're doing Fibonacci I, and I goes from 1 to 30. Let's just analyze this a little bit. So we get some timings, and they come out to be some particular values here as these things start increasing. And so it starts to get bad. And of course, this timing is giving us the actual result of the time and the result. We're not interested in the result, so we can just map first onto this particular list here and call that timings. And we can actually get just these particular times out there. So this looks like it's going badly, like an exponential. So let's actually turn around and try and find a fit for this, fit of this particular of the timings. And what kind of model are we going to use? We're going to use a plus b e to some x or cx here. And so what are the model parameters we've got here? We've got an a and a b and a c in our model here. And we're going to refine it with respect to x. And so this particularly, we've got an x here. So x equals dot. And so we don't want that. And so we can turn around and get the results. And so those are some parameters that fit it. Let's actually substitute that into the model to get that's the model that's found. And let's call this the fit, for instance. OK, so we get some particular results. And let's actually go and plot these things. So let's plot the fit. And x goes from 1, 0 to 30, for instance, like so. And we get a plot for it. And let's actually compare that to the actual values of points we get. Let's plot of the timings we have. And they go somewhat the same. Let's show one on top of the other. Oh, and that means we've got to name them, of course. Call this p1 equals that. P2 equals this here. And let's show p1 comma p2. And so they match pretty well. Notice here, it's cut off at 0.5, even though we had timings up here of 2.6 and 1.6. And so that's typically what plot will do. It'll cut off some of the extreme values in your plot. And it puts the, like, what's that? We could do a log plot. We could. What's the second argument of log plot? There we go. A list log plot. There we go. Ooh, that's kind of nice. So we see that. Let's actually go back and take a look at this particular one. I was going to actually talk about the plot range here, and we wanted to actually get the full plot range here, and so we can make that 0 to 3 if we wanted, and do the exact same computation and show it, and see we have a nice match, and we've got the full range. And so we can see we do actually have an exponential fit to our Fibonacci. And of course, if 500 points were way beyond the many, many lifetimes of the universe, so it's an incredibly bad algorithm to do this. So what would be a better algorithm than what we've got? Well, the simplest thing we could actually extend would be to actually get this particular definition of the Fibonacci numbers here and cache them. So in this example, I'm going to sort of walk through, so what would sort of do the naive version, a better version, an even better version, and something like Mathematica would actually do it. So in here, would actually turn around, and instead of actually computing it afresh each time, once we've actually computed it once, we can actually cache that value. And so it'll remember this value. It's sort of formatted because of it. But what we're doing, each time it's matching, and each time it's actually going to figure it out, it will remember the result of that particular Fibonacci number. And it'll be quite fast then. And so then it's now linear. We can now get that 700th number, and it agrees with the 700th number of the Fibonacci numbers. So we've got something that's time efficient-ish. And we can, but unfortunately, as we take a look at the numbers here, it's cached them. It's cached all of them. It's cached every single one of them. It's cached lots of them, many of them, right towards the end, and so on. And it goes. We have lots of Fibonacci numbers that have been cached. OK, and then we have the final definition. So it's not space efficient. It's time efficient, but not space efficient. So we can do even better than this. So this would be a sort of one version. A more intelligent version now is actually do this iteration in reverse here. So we would say fib of some n is going to be equal to fib aux of, we're going to start out with 1. We'll do one number. It's already done. We'll be less than 1 here. We put on here integer, slash semicolon, n is greater than 0, so we only match certain patterns. And then here, this fib aux, we're going to actually iterate for every one of these iterates. We've got the sort of total here. We've got the previous total. We've got n. And that is going to be, of course, our fib aux of now. We've got a new total after we've gone one step into the future, total plus previous total, comma, total. So it's moved over and up 1, and our numbers go down by 1. And of course, we need a stopping condition once we get to total, comma, these things here. We've got to 0. We just want to return the total. OK, and so fib of 8 gives us our numbers. Fib of 700 now gives us the right sort of numbers. We can have, how many digits have we got. So we've now got something that's both space efficient and time efficient. And so we can start to actually push this to higher degrees. So let's actually take a look here at fib of, 700 and, put it, 4,000 or something. It works. But, or 4,000. Yeah, we could, but we'll do this. I'm actually going to get down to that. So, of course, I just wanted to actually point out the iteration limits, of course. And so iteration limit here in the Fibonacci sequence, of course, this Fibonacci is being, of one variant, is being rewritten to Fibonacci aux again at each step and each time. And so there's a limit on the iteration, of course, that built in by default for Mathematica so that you don't shoot yourself in the foot of 4096. You can change it, of course. And so let's actually go ahead and actually change that. So how do we change it? During this particular iteration, we want to pretend that iteration limit is actually infinite. So we're using block again to actually modify the properties. And so during the inner bit of the block, the iteration limit will be infinite. And of course, now we can do this kind of computation. We can take a look at the integer length of the Fibonacci here. Take a look at 5,000. We can go to, you know, 100, you know, a million digits of Fibonacci here, and we can actually find out that our algorithm isn't too bad, and it takes a little bit to get there, but 200,000 digits is our Fibonacci number. But if we take a look and turn around the real Fibonacci of Mathematica out at a million digits here, at a millionth number, and also take a look at its integer length, it goes exceedingly fast. So it's got an even better algorithm internally, and in fact, we could turn around and go up to, you know, a billion digits, the billionth Fibonacci number, and it'll actually turn around. And so the Fibonacci number inside Mathematica, it's getting like now maybe about 200 million digits of the Fibonacci number. And it does this, you know, quite fast time. So the moral here is that Mathematica, to a large degree, will do to do what you tell it. And so you need to choose the algorithms which are actually sensible. And as Nikolai just sort of said, one of the things we can actually do is look for a closed form solution. And so this is one of the Fibonacci number. If you do the exercises where you find sequence functions or something else like that, you'll actually find this is the closed form solution for Fibonacci numbers. And so we can take a look at it, the 21st number here, and go root reduce using a different algorithm here in Mathematica. And it indeed will come out to be Fibonacci of 21. And of course, this goes up to much higher things. Did we want to go up to, you know, root reduce of that? We'll go up to a million digits, I guess, here. Yes, and that's one of the exercises that I put in on my exercises. So it's not that difficult. So and we want to just check that is indeed a Fibonacci of a million, and indeed it's true. So this is a really reasonably good example of Fibonacci. I mean, you know, it's a pretty simple sort of thing, but we can have this bone-dead sort of algorithm, which is really bad, it's very exponential. We can make something a little bit better, which is efficient in time but not in space. We can be even a little bit more clever and actually get something that's space and time efficient. But internally, Mathematica, of course, will actually, people have thought about this long and hard, will come up with a very efficient algorithm to actually do the computation. So this is illustrative of sort of the balance that you do when you, you know, compute these things and work with them. It's sort of illustrative of what we do. What's the limitations of sort of what? So it's a straight iteration. So it basically, instead of going top down, it goes sort of bottom up. You can imagine. And so it, at each stage, it's getting the Fibonacci number for the next one, and then you get the next one, and so on. So it's indeed. Do you? So it's quite interesting. You actually mentioned this last time. The Pedro numbers. And so that's an example that I've got. So coming up, I'm going to give you the example of Pedro numbers. You could do that as well. Yep, you could do that. But then it's still possibly constructing. It constructs that tree the first time. It has to go all the way down to actually find some values so it can sort of start unwinding its stack. So it has to build that stack all the way down. No. Then you've got exponentials. If not, you could actually start collecting the coefficients, I guess, of these things as you go down. Yeah, you could go down. It's easier this way. But yeah, you could choose other sorts of algorithms. So given that, and given the time, we probably want to finish at 1:30, 10 minutes? What to do? Oh, it's such a good example. So this is an example here of actually the differentiation. I won't do it. I'll encourage you to be able to do it. And I'll do two rules of it. So first year calculus, you know, I don't know, a third of the course will be, you know, involved in implementing differentiation. Everybody here knows how to implement differentiation. But we can actually do it in Mathematica ourselves. It's, of course, built in. We get some value here. But the exercise is to actually turn around and write your own D. We'll call it, I don't know, script D of this particular thing. We'll actually write your own derivative. And so we want derivative of some sort of product like that to do something. And so to do that, we could, you know, just turn around. We've got a couple rules that are pretty simple. If we've got an f plus a g, you know, some linearity with respect to some x, that's just going to be simply our script D of, you know, f comma x plus script D of g comma x. And so then if I have some particular input here, I put a plus there instead, and put a plus here instead, and I evaluate this, we'll see some distributivity of our differential. It's split it up into two bits. And of course, then we could actually get that. We could have a product of these things. And so that would be, of course, f times, well, derivative of f x comma g plus the f times the derivative of g of x. And so now it'll work for this particular example. And so we see this d of 2 comma x, for instance. We could take a look and say, well, of course, anything that doesn't actually have the variable in it, some f with respect to x, if f is free of x, should of course be 0. So now this particular derivative, this d2 of x term right here, that'll drop out. And so on. And so then we write some powers, we write some other rules, and it's not too hard. In fact, I've got it right here. You write it as following, just a simple sort of set of rules like this, and you've implemented differentiation, and so we could actually go, here's the normal derivative here, and here's our particular version, the exact same thing. I'll just get that there and do this. Here, and you actually see these two particular results agree. So I can just define my own derivative here. I use Gothic D or something. But I would encourage you to do this particular example yourself. It's very simple. You know all the rules. There's nothing really complicated, no Grassmann variables running around or anything else. So it's something you can easily do, and it'll be very illustrative for the pattern matching abilities. And of course, once you can do this, then you can define your own derivatives. That's your theoretical physicist. That's what you do. You have some differentiation that does something a little bit weird, a little bit funky. And normal differentiation in Mathematica is not what you want. You want something different. And so being able to actually define these kinds of things is very important. So I'll just encourage you to see if you can do that yourself. Write your own version of differentiation for simple, you know, exponentials, logs, products, chains, powers, those kinds of things. Oh, yeah. Yeah, really simple. So it's this particular rule right here. So, sure. So you are interested now in my derivative, huh? So sine of x of cosine of x squared, for instance. So something else like that with respect to x, yeah? Well, it won't know. Sorry, it's got some values. Let's get rid of some values here. So it doesn't know any particular derivatives on, it's not free. Does it match that particular rule? Cool. I'll look at it after. But yeah, I'm sure we can have a simple extension, or if not, it's an exercise for the class to actually make this work. But you should be able to do this. I mean, it's I've got how many minutes? 6 minutes? So now is your chance. Defy the odds. Prove me wrong. Prove them wrong. And actually, it's simple differentiation. Just do the exercise. And it's a really illustrative. I think, in fact, this is possibly one of the best exercises in the whole school because, and of course, Pedro and Nicolai, it's crazy. We want to do eigenvalues and solve energy levels and stuff like that. But this is much more of what you actually use, we would do sort of internally in Mathematica. This is much more akin to what would actually internally, the way Mathematica really sort of works in various bits. So And it sort of captures it all. And you've got all the knowledge you need to actually do it. So that should match. I'm actually kind of surprised it doesn't here. We've got f of g. Why is that not matching? No, that will actually work for things like, my time is slipping away, f of x, comma x. And so if I don't have that rule in there, if I get rid of that, that will actually evaluate and we'll get with respect to some bad things happening. You mean this, not same cube. I don't actually think, still got some problems there. But even with, can I get my last 6 minutes to do Pedro numbers? No? So I'd like to talk about context here. So this has come up a little bit about what context the various things live in. And so right now, Mathematica is actually working in the global context. And so if I define a new variable, foo equals 3, and actually asked what context is that in, it turns out that foo lives in the global context. It's its namespace. It's where it actually lives. And so there's actually this thing called the context path. And this tells us where there's some crud on here that you can sort of ignore, but the packet manager. But basically, there's the system in the global context right now, the way we've got it. And so if I actually take a look at the context of many Mathematica symbols itself, like integer, you see that it actually lives on the system context. And I can actually turn around and say, what are all the names of everything that actually lives on the system context? So this is internal to Mathematica. And so I'd see this, and it's a big, long list. And so, of course, you know now how to just sort of get some summary of big, long lists. We'd actually turn around and actually take the length of that. And so we can actually see what's defined. This has got 5,568 symbols right now in the actual system context. There's a lot of stuff in Mathematica. And when we want to actually put these things in different contexts, we can actually prefix it with our, fish of, Bob equals 3. And so that's Bob is now, if I actually ask for Bob, because the context path doesn't actually have fish on the context path, there's no information about Bob, but I can actually refer to it as fish. So what I could do is I could, for the Andrew de Sitter space or something, I'm writing some package. Let's begin working in that particular context. If I go back now and take a look at the context path, we'll find it's not actually on there, but any new symbols defined will actually be working in the latest context that we're in right now. So it works in the combination of both of them. And so if I define this bar equal to 3 here, and I actually ask, what's bar? Well, it's in the Andy de Sitter space, the ADS thing sort of here, and end it, and if I can refer to bar, again, it knows nothing about it, but it's actually in this particular space. So contexts are kind of important, and in fact, what we do when we write packages is we turn around and we put lots of stuff actually into a package. So, and actually, the help system does exactly this. This is an option. In the option inspector, it's weird and deep, powerful magic. You could do that with the begin and an end. I think so. It will not? Okay, we'll try it later. Okay, Pedro numbers. I need to get to Pedro numbers. So I wanted to actually briefly talk about programming in the large. Of course, when you do this, because you're going to get develop notebooks, they're going to be bigger. You should structure things in the right way. So here's some source code for the notation package as well. And you can see it's sort of laid out. I'm not going to walk over it all and everything. But you see, there's some package beginnings. There's some general error handling. There's some utility functions. If I want to find out about utility functions, I can open that section. What do strip styling boxes do? I can go down there. There's the error checking for it. There's its definition. Tells it what it's going to do. Some nice sort of, clear sort of definitions. And so you can find your way around this whole package. The package beginnings is the same sort of thing. It's not just, 1,000 lines of code. and you know, in a big file that you know that you can't sort of follow. So it's very important that you actually structure your packages to be readable. Other people can come in and actually look at them. You follow normal conventions, use capital names, use full words, and put things in the right sort of places. So let's actually talk about Pedro numbers. So Pedro, of course, said the things would be squared. You can just square it. And so he reflexively wanted to sort of square things. So let's actually talk about Pedro numbers is our package here. And so let's say this package, it's going to be big enough here, maybe 150%. This package will provide functions to compute the awesomely large Pedro numbers. Okay, so we've got some particular things. And what is a Pedro number? Pedro numbers are going to be, we'll go back to our Fibonacci numbers here, and we'll turn around and get... we talked about that with some of the bits, but we never sort of actually did the Wolfram Storr bit. So I don't know. It's been discussed. So let's say the Pedro number here, the nth Pedro number is going to be equal to the Pedro number of n minus 1 plus the Pedro number of n minus 2. But of course, because Pedro likes to square things, it's going to be squared. So and of course, the Pedro number here of 0 is going to be 0, and Pedro of 1 is going to be equal to 1. And of course, Pedro, we can do some kind of calculation on Pedro here of like 7. Gives us a nice large number. And the same way as we did it before, we could actually turn around and give a better definition of Pedro numbers by putting in some sort of auxiliary, but this trick is, of course, we just square it when we're working backwards. And do that. And so we'll go and clear all Pedro. And so we can compute again the Pedro number, the seventh Pedro number. And of course, this time we're not doubly iterative. What's that? We can protect Pedro as well. 30, ooh, that's getting a bit large already for Pedro gets large numbers here. So let's just quit that kernel. Can't quite handle Pedro. And so let's make that, 20, something else. Okay, so we can get some sort of large numbers, some Pedro numbers here. So that's how we'd actually implement it. Let's put this into a package. And so what we'd actually do at the beginning is we'd go begin package. And we're going to be getting the Pedro package. And so inside the Pedro here, and so let's actually use full names for this instead of just Pedro. We're actually going to call this Pedro number, and we're going to use capitals because that's what Mathematica does for all the bits to be good. And so we just get Pedro and replace Pedro by Pedro numbers here. And clear all Pedro right here. Okay, and so we've got some Pedro numbers. Put the kernel here, Pedro. Okay, and so we've got some Pedro numbers here, and we can compute the seventh one as we want. Okay, some syntax coloring right there. And so what we'd actually do is we want to also include a usage message. So we want Pedro number to be equal in usage, so when people actually look at this package and they load it up and then actually take a look at it, they can actually find their way around. And so we say Pedro number. Let me finish, and then we'll talk about the syntax coloring in a second. So Pedro number computes the nth large Pedro number, and this is, conjectured by Pedro to always be sufficiently large. Okay. We've got a nice message here for Pedro number. And so what we're doing here with the begin, and so now we can actually turn around and we want to begin the actual private context. And so what's going on here? So this will define Pedro number as we evaluate this will be in the Pedro context. And in fact, if we go context of Pedro number, we'll actually see it's in the Pedro context. But some of this other stuff later on, this Pedro number aux and the ends and everything else, we want this to be in this private context, to be hidden, and so not be involved with this. So after that, we can be, again, private. And so now, when we actually define these numbers, all the rest of the symbols that aren't already defined and recognized will be defined in this private context. And so we can end the package, which ends the private package, and then we can end the package here, which ends the actual package. Let's just tidy this all up. Quit that. Put the various things in. Put some stuff. Evaluate all of that. And that's what our Pedro numbers would now do. Pedro number, we can actually see, is 7. Okay, so we've got all the various definitions in our package. It's all nicely tidied. We've got some usage strings. We've used the right conventions. What we'd like to do now is actually make all of these, save it into a package. So I go here, and I actually make all of these cells, cell properties, initialization cells. And so now I can actually save this as a package. So I go save as, and I'll put this out as a package. And we'll make this pedro.m here on the desktop, I think. I think it saved there on the desktop, did it? Pedro.m, indeed it did. Right, Pedro, and so now I can just actually go here, go to my library, Mathematica. This is on your chain of the user dollar base directory or whatever. And so put in here, I can put Pedro. I've actually got a version in there, Pedro, and we'll replace them. And so now I can actually just go hide that, go here, quit my kernel, and I can actually load up Pedro. And I can actually ask, what are the names in the actual Pedro context? And I can see I've got Pedro numbers, and I can take a look at a Pedro number. And it gives me a nice usage string. It's always conjectured to be sufficiently large, which is good. And I can actually do some computations in Pedro numbers. Okay, so that's a quick introduction to how to actually use packages and define your own contexts and how things are structured in context. So we're skipping a bit. I'll just skip to the summary then. You should choose your algorithms wisely. For matching, always remember to match on the full forms of expressions. Attributes will control the evaluation and the pattern matching of expressions. And in the next lecture, I'll talk more on things about parallelism, execution speeds, and linking to external binaries and other goodies. Okay.
Given time, maybe we have time for one question only, and then you can ask questions during lunch and during the exercises.
Sure. Dot M and dot. I'm not sure. There's a difference between dot M and dot MX, and I'm not too sure with the latest extension of Wolfram Language. I know that we're pushing that, and I should actually know the answer to this, but I've never actually looked at a Wolfram Language file, so I'm guessing that it's the same sort of format. We could actually try save our package as a dot Wolfram Language and see what it actually does, just as an experiment. It'll probably go horribly wrong, but do we have this save as a Wolfram Language? Yep, Pedro 2 dot Wolfram Language. What do I do? Pedro 2 Wolfram Language and take a look at it. For this example, it appears to be none. There's no difference, I guess. I would hazard a guess that possibly we've renamed it that. So yeah. But I'll check and we'll see later on if there's any other distinctions.
Very good. Let's thank Jason, go for lunch, and meet again at 2:30.